MacCast, Monday, October 1st, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Got another great show for you today. Glad that you are here hanging out with me once again. We got lots of things to get into. Big thing last week was, of course, Apple's whole map issues and troubles. We're going to dive into that a little bit. We're also going to take a look at some of the other news and information coming up surrounding sales of the iPhone 5, how those are doing, some Apple TV updates, and even a little tiny bit, just a smidgen, of Mac news. We're going to eke in there also all of your feedback and some tips and tricks and stuff like that to get to. So hang in there. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies. They actually have two great products now. I've told you for a long time about Notebook, and I've been recently telling you about iTrash, both things that you should go check out over at circusponies.com. You know, Notebook is a great tool for getting organized, for doing research, for taking notes. Now is a great time of year to take a look at it. A lot of you are probably getting ready to go back to school. Maybe you're getting ready to go on that final vacation of the year, something like that. Notebook is great for organizing all that stuff. You can do lists, you can do outlines, and you can even do different styles of notes. So if you have different kinds of note-taking and outlining you type like to do, it supports all of that. One of the reasons is because notebook documents look just like your paper notebooks, with pages and tabs and different kinds of rules, different types of paper. You can even have sections. You can add sticky notes and flags just like you would with a traditional real world notebook, and you can do it all digitally, saving paper, saving the environment. It's really great. And all of that stuff gets automatically indexed, giving you different ways to browse and search through that document. You can have link backs, you can have track backs, you can have integration with your calendar, with your contacts, and it makes it all simple and easy to get organized. So check out Notebook. Also, while you're there, take a look at iTrash. This now gives you the ability to put your trash icon back on your desktop in a fixed position. So it's not constantly bouncing around in your dock. The problem with the trash can in the dock is it's not always in the same place. So if you're a mouse dragger and clicker, and I'm one of those people, totally guilty of that, I don't use keyboard shortcuts as much as I probably should, you can now drag stuff right to the trash and it'll always be in the same spot on your desktop, just like it was in the good old days. And not only that, they allow you to customize the trash icon with 20 different animated iTrash characters that are built into the app. Even has sounds, so it brings back some of that nostalgia of some of the customizations we could do back in the OS 9 days. So I like it for that. And also has some great contextual menu options with easy access to doing things like secure empty trash, force emptying the trash. How many times have you had it where something gets stuck in the trash? You can force it with iTrash to get out of there. And you can even get quick access to ejecting mounted volumes, and all for just $4.95. It's available on the Circus Ponies website. So check it all out. Get more information and details over at circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So apparently now all of us users of iPhone 5s and iOS 6 and the iPod Touches running iOS 6, basically anybody who's upgraded to iOS 6, I guess at this point, did you know we're all in a mapocalypse, at least according to Wired Magazine? And it was definitely evident. I think we're in a news mapocalypse, if I can say that, because definitely this past week, the top story, everybody seemed to be talking about the troubles of Apple's new map application in iOS 6, or at least the perceived troubles. I don't really know. I kind of gave a pretty long commentary on the MacCast member show. I also talked with Mac OS Ken Ray about this for his Day 6 program. And I have to wonder if this whole thing isn't just being a little bit overdone. But now that the maps have hit the streets, and yes, that's totally a pun intended, on 1 million different screens and devices, it's become apparent that a lot of people are finding little issues, little problems with Apple's mapping data. And so the big question is, Did Apple know about these issues? And if so, could they have absolutely done something about it before they shipped the product? A lot of people are questioning whether or not Apple maybe or maybe should have not shipped the Maps application in iOS 6, many feeling that it's kind of not finished. Well, users, what's happening is users are finding point of interest data and information that's in the wrong place. They're reporting getting bad directions. There's definitely less detail in some areas, specifically internationally, on the Maps versus what was available with the Google-powered version of the Maps app that was in iOS 5. And there are other odd little visual issues with things like flyover, specifically warped bridges and areas where the texture mapping isn't quite right. So all of this mounts up to looking like Apple has a big problem with their Maps application. The issues do seem to be, for some reason, more prevalent outside of the U.S., and we're likely getting more reports of that because iOS 6 and the new Maps and the iPhone 5 had a much more aggressive international rollout. So it's in a lot more hands, it's under a lot more scrutiny in many more places, and so any faults are going to be found pretty quickly and obviously have been. Now, one expert claims that the issues are likely due to Apple trying to merge data from multiple sources and, more importantly, relying on computer algorithms rather than human experts to kind of vet and check that information to actually look at validating it. And so some stuff slipped through the cracks. To me, it's seeming by everything that I read that executives at Apple, even engineers at Apple, really didn't realize they had the kinds of problems that they did. And they shipped the product thinking it was finished and done and much better than the public is sort of finding out it is, at least in terms of the data perspective. I really want to focus on the fact that this is a data issue versus necessarily Apple shipping a really bad application, because I don't really feel that way. Now, a lot of people are wishing and hoping that Google will release a standalone version for iOS of the Map application through the Mac App Store. As a matter of fact, some reports this past week said it was even already ready to go, that Google had already submitted it or was getting ready to submit it to Apple's App Store for review. And then we had some other reports saying, no, that's not the case. It's not even going to be ready until the end of this year. Eric Schmidt officially was quoted as saying at an event in Korea that Google has not done anything yet. Now, that doesn't mean to say they haven't already been working on a standalone application. It just says they're not ready to move forward with whatever plans they might have, or maybe they don't have any plans at all. We really don't know. It's just speculation at this point. And who knows why Google would be holding back. Maybe they feel Apple won't approve their application, or maybe they're just really not interested in delivering that type of product to iOS. We do know in the meantime that one workaround, if you want to get Google Maps back on your iOS device, would be to use the web application and create an icon on your home screen. And Google is planning, apparently, to add some of the features that we lost in the transition to the iOS 6 Maps app back into the web version of their application. According to David Pogue, Google is getting ready to add Street View into the iOS mobile version of their application within the next couple weeks, so that's good news for anybody who's looking for sort of a stopgap workaround to get them by in the meantime till maybe Google does something. Also, the web version of the application does have the transit directions, which is another thing that many people are upset over the loss of in iOS 6. So as I mentioned, I covered my thoughts on the whole Mapocalypse thing pretty extensively on the latest MacCast member show. Also talked a little bit with Ken Ray, and I thought would just give you a quick summary of where I'm at with this whole thing. So yes, there definitely are some problems, but I think in general, Apple's Map application is an amazing start to their own version of Maps, and it has some great functionality, and it's really well executed. And I don't think that some of the criticism that they're getting is necessarily warranted. I think some people are having trouble seeing the forest through the trees, and the trees being these little issues that are cropping up. I know with the weak spots being pointed out on different blogs and Tumblr and on Twitter and stuff like that, it makes it really easy to see where the problems are. and call Apple out on it. People can point to the warts and go, ah, there they are. But it doesn't really answer the question of exactly how many warts there are or how extensive this is. And until we really understand that, I'm finding it hard personally to be super critical of what Apple has done. What I'd like to know is from mapping experts, how bad is the data that Apple has? And more importantly, is it outside any kind of normal variances for mapping systems? All mapping systems, as far as I know, have certain errors and shortcomings. And is what Apple has implemented, is it worse or far worse than the other stuff that's out there? Most of the testing that I've seen being done seems to be centered around the turn-by-turn directions with Apple's maps and putting it against the stuff that's in Google Android. And in those cases, Apple seems to be faring very well. And that's sort of been my experience. Another one of the big criticisms seems to be the fact that it's believed Apple still had a year left on their contract with Google. So why would they ship this mapping product and do it early, what looks like a year early from the end of their contract, cutting Google out and getting rid of what most people considered at this point to be much better mapping data? And for that part of it, you know, my opinion is I don't know that Apple would be that much better off a year from now shipping the product versus just shipping it now and making incremental improvements and getting the feedback and stuff like that. I think another year would just give Google a larger head start, more time to tweak their apps and keep more features out of the iOS version of the maps. And that's sort of what we're hearing was part of the issue here and why Apple wanted to move away from Google's product. What the reports have been saying is that, in essence, Apple and Google tried to reach an agreement. Apple wanted more access to things like turn-by-turn directions, access to vector-based maps, which they had on Android, and Android was sort of leapfrogging iOS's version of maps, and Apple wanted a lot of those features and functionalities within their built-in application that they were shipping on iOS. And Google, for their part, well, they wanted access to more personal information about users, specifically in the realm of Google Latitude, which is their location-based stuff, and they also wanted more upfront branding within the Maps application. And that's typically something that Apple just doesn't provide for their partners. They want their stuff to be their stuff. They license the technology, and that's sort of how they work. So at some point, talks seem to have broken down, or maybe talks didn't even necessarily break down, because some of the reports that we're hearing is that just before WWDC, Apple kind of sprung it on Google that, hey, we're going with our own mapping solution. We're not going to use your stuff anymore. And then they proceeded to show off some early versions of Apple Maps. And Apple, you know, a lot of the reports are saying that Google was caught off guard. I find that a little bit hard to believe, again, because Apple had been acquiring for a couple years different mapping companies. We reported on it on the MacCast. I have to imagine that Google was noticing it going on. So they had to have an inkling that Apple was getting ready to do something. Maybe they were shocked that Apple was doing it a year earlier than they thought they might. But regardless, I think it was the right time for Apple to move forward with their mapping solution. And so the biggest challenges for Apple now are going to be cleaning up the data that they have. Most experts believe that the problem is this aggregated data. There's estimates that Apple is using as many as 20 different sources for different bits of mapping data and information, and that the only way Apple can kind of fix things now is going to be by hiring staff and getting experts in who can comb through the information and make it more accurate. And they seem to be actually making some steps toward that. We saw a report this week from TechCrunch that Apple is reportedly actively trying to recruit and hire former Google Maps employees to help resolve some of these issues. And we also know from some of the reports we've been reading that Google went through exactly the same process. They, when they first launched their mapping applications, tried to use aggregate data, tried to use data from other sources, and found very quickly that they were going to have to do it all on their own. That's when they started deploying vehicles and doing Street View and actually checking this stuff with real humans and things like that. So I know for some that Maps is this really critical feature that they want to have on their device, and it's really nice to have a built-in solution. But I think another thing that Apple has going for it, and another reason why they don't have as much risk in releasing their version of the Maps app and iteratively working on it is that there are a ton of alternative map applications on the App Store. And I think if it's the worst issue that Apple has had with iOS 6 and the launch of the iPhone 5, if this is as bad as any of Apple's competitors can point out, if this is the thing that they're going to choose to point to, then I think Apple's done incredibly well, and it shows how good a package Apple has put together with the iPhone and iOS 6. Because yes, Maps is kind of a big deal, but there's a lot bigger problems that Apple could have faced with the launch of iOS 6 and the new iPhone. So it seems to me in a lot of ways that competitors and the media and everybody's just looking for something to take Apple down on, and this week it got in a frenzied, crazy fury saying that Maps was going to be the thing. There have been literally and legitimately reports saying that the Maps debacle could be the downfall of Apple. I think that's so far from the truth. I think Apple is going to get on top of this. I think they're going to put a lot of money and resources behind it. I think we're going to see them do that. It's sort of a learning curve. This is really a new area for Apple. The one thing, and I mentioned this in my member show, that I think I fault Apple with is sort of over promoting new software and new technologies that they're developing in their 1.0 versions or even beta versions like we've seen in the case of Siri. So Maps is a 1.0 product, and I think a lot of people, because Apple has marketed it so heavily and made it such a prominent feature of iOS 6 and the new iPhone, that a lot of people forget that Apple's just getting started with this. Google has had 7 years and thousands of man hours, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of probably man hours of resources thrown at mapping, and Apple's just getting up to speed. So I think where the proof is going to be is where and how Apple makes Maps a priority and how hard they work on fixing this and how quickly they move to catch up with a lot of the features and functionality that Google has in their mapping system. And that's just going to take time over the next year, over the next couple months. I think we're going to see how Apple responds. And so far, I think it's been really good. Tim Cook came out, issued a public apology. I kind of think that he went a little bit too far because, once again, in my personal opinion, I don't think Maps are that bad. But that's the step, and that's the way Apple has chosen to handle this. And I applaud Tim Cook for having the courage to do that. A lot of people are pulling in the whole Steve Jobs card and saying, well, Steve Jobs wouldn't do that. And I've always maintained that I am really glad Tim Cook is being Tim Cook, and he's doing his own thing, and he's running Apple his way. So as much as I think the apology was a little bit too much of an apology, because I really think Maps is a good application. It made it seem, I think, to some, and the public perception in my mind that it gave was that Apple was admitting that there was something intimately or deeply flawed with the Maps application. And I don't think that's the case. I think it's a really good first start, and it's going to be fun to see where Apple takes it next. So those are sort of my thoughts. I'm sure you have some thoughts and opinions, so please send me feedback. Send your comments to maccast@gmail.com. Well, one thing is for certain, though. The whole Maps thing has not slowed iPhone 5 demand or iPhone 5 sales. It continues to surge forward. On Monday, Apple had announced that they sold 5 million iPhone 5s in the first opening weekend of sales, the first 3 days. That beat last year's record of 4 million iPhone 4Ss, so it's sold incredibly well in the opening weekend and in the week that followed. But despite having those record numbers, some analysts still believe Apple fell short of their predictions. It's only speculation at this point, but some of them are thinking that supply constraints, particularly the yields on the new in-plane touch panel displays, may have lowered the availability of initial stock that Apple had to sell, thus resulting in slightly slower sales or lower numbers of sales than they could have potentially had. Another prediction or theory is that Apple may have been holding back some of the quantities so that they could continue with their aggressive multi-country international rollout of the iPhone so that they would have stock on hand to deliver to those additional countries. And that happened this week. As a matter of fact, over the weekend, the iPhone 5 became available in 28 other countries. So we're still waiting on updated sales numbers from Apple, but I would expect the numbers to be quite good. Shipments do seem to be coming in slowly, but at a steady stream. So if you didn't get one on day one, you have to keep checking checking back with your local stores. Also, carrier stores seem to have availability often when Apple stores don't. I did a quick check on the Apple website, and current ship times in the U.S. seem to be at about 3 to 4 weeks. I have heard people going into the Apple retail stores and finding stock. And also, if you go on Apple's website, they have an in-store pickup option. And if you order online between the hours of 10 p.m. and 4 p.m., they will show you, I believe, local availability for your Apple retail stores in your region, and you can schedule next day in-store pickup, although they do note that limited quantities are available at this point. So that could be a way to check if you've been waiting on or trying to get a hold of your iPhone 5. And even with those constrained and sort of slow supplies, Morgan Stanley analyst Katie Huberty is predicting very bullish numbers on Apple's future iPhone sales outlook. She sees Apple selling 25 million iPhones in the September quarter, which just ended, with another 50 million iPhones being sold in the December quarter, which would be record-breaking numbers for Apple for sure. She even goes further to say that those numbers may be conservative, especially if Apple can shore up their supply chain to better meet demand. And with China coming on board soon, she predicts that Apple could sell 200 million iPhones in 2013. So no doubt Apple has got a big winner on their hands with the iPhone 5. All analysts seem to be predicting similar numbers, although I think Katie Huberty is particularly positive on Apple's sales outlook. The other thing that Apple announced earlier last week was that iOS 6 saw 100 million users convert or upgrade to the new version of the iOS operating system. This was on Monday following its release, so just after a few days. I'm sure adoption rates are up even higher at this point, but again, iOS 6 is doing very well. Something like, I think I read another report of one website predicting adoption rates have been about 40% of users running iOS who could upgrade have already upgraded to iOS version 6. Along with the release of iOS 6 for the iPhone and the iPod Touch, Apple also did release an update for second generation and third generation Apple TVs. Interestingly, the update is labeled build 10A406E and doesn't carry the same iOS 6 moniker that Apple is using on other devices, non-Apple TV devices. The update does feature a number of really nice enhancements, including support for shared photo streams. AirPlay now gives you the ability to send audio from your Apple TV to AirPlay-powered speakers. There's also an option to require an on-screen code to use AirPlay with the Apple TV. Apple added in trailers, which also gives you the ability to search for local movie times. You can have multiple iTunes accounts registered now and switch between those accounts on your Apple TV. There's some new screensavers. Also, you have the ability to reorder icons on the home screen. You do that by holding down the select button on your remote, and that allows you to navigate and move your icons around so you can better organize that stuff. They added subtitles, including SDH support for deaf and hard of hearing users, as well as improvements for viewing and reading subtitles. There's advanced networking options now, and you can add configuration profiles for your networks, and then also just general performance and stability improvements. So if you're a second generation or third generation Apple TV owner, you probably want to head over to your device and run your software update if you haven't picked this one up yet, because there's some nice enhancements in there. We continue to get more information about Apple's latest iPhone processor, the A6, that made its debut in the iPhone 5. Original reports were speculating that the clock speed on the new chip was around 1 gigahertz. That was based on some of the early performance benchmarks we saw. Additional testing has seemed to reveal that it goes all the way up to 1.3 gigahertz, and so there was some speculation and information coming out about why we're seeing varied clock speeds with the chip, and now it's believed that there may be some technology in there to actually adjust the clock speed dependent upon the needs of the application or the specific process that's happening at any given time. I've actually read reports that show the chip clocking all the way down to actually 550 megahertz, and the Geekbench app reports the chip at a clock speed of 1.3 gigahertz. So the theory as to what's going on here is that the chip is smart enough to adapt itself and slow the clock speed down, use less processor cycles when they aren't needed, resulting in better battery life and better performance overall. So it can ramp up to do high performance applications and then slow down when you're doing things, simple tasks like text editing or email, something like that. You don't need all of those cycles. So that's a pretty good, cool thing. And either way, early benchmarks and real world performance tests show that the iPhone 5 is definitely faster, maybe even faster than the 2x performance increase that Apple alluded to in the launch event. I saw some reports reporting that in some tests, it's showing 3 times, if not more, the performance. And some of that may be due to the doubled amount of RAM. We do know it was ramped up from 512 megabytes to 1 gigabyte, so they can do more caching thing. A lot of that also has to do with the additional GPU core that's in there. It's been revealed that it's a 3-core GPU helping with the graphics performance and some of the additional image processing and things like that. So no doubt the iPhone 5 is absolutely a screamer in terms of the processor, but also can adjust itself, which is really pretty neat. It's also believed now that because of all of this, Apple really custom built this chip that had kind of come out earlier, but additional reports now are showing that this may be one of the first chips developed in a long time that has some hand layout done to it. It's looking like the ARM core blocks were actually manually laid out, which is something that's typically not done because it can add to the cost of producing the chip, but what it results in is faster processing speed. It can also add to some of the costs and make the chips a little bit more expensive, but this speculation comes out due to some additional analysis done by iFixit and ChipWorks. I think they go in there with microscopic, you know, analysis and also x-ray analysis of these chipsets to kind of see what's going on, and when they looked at the layout of the ARM cores, it seemed to indicate or give the impression that it was actually laid out by hand, which is pretty cool. More details are also starting to come into play on Apple's new Lightning connectors and cables. Apparently, they have some significant technology behind them, making them much more than simple connector and cable. Double Helix Cables has been doing a teardown and hacking the cables, and they made some interesting discoveries, one of which is that the cables appear to have an authentication chip in the connector that could potentially render any third-party non-Apple cables useless, at least if the cable manufacturer doesn't license the technology or add the chipsets coming from Apple. They go so far as to even warn customers to avoid some of the non-Apple cables that are beginning to surface online, as they probably will not work without this authentication chip in play. They also determined that in order to achieve the reversibility of the pins and the orientation-free operation of the cables, that Apple appears to be getting by that issue by at least partially using a dynamically assigned pin system, so that when you plug in the cable, it recognizes which direction it's plugged into and then dynamically switches the pins to make the appropriate connections. Now, some of the pins, like the power pin, appear to be actually symmetrical, meaning that pin 1 on one side actually connects to pin 8 on the other side, but they're finding that not all of the pins are like that, that many of them are addressed straight across, and therefore, there must be something happening with the connector chips in the iPhone to actually dynamically assign those pins. Double Helix Cables has been doing this all because they're actually making custom iPhone 5 Lightning cables, a little bit shorter ones, a little bit different in terms of design. They run about $85 through their website, but you have to supply them with an existing Apple cable so they can get access to the chips that they need and the connectors. This is something like HyperMac used to do with the MagSafe connectors on some of their battery packs until Apple shut them down. So we'll have to see how long they let Double Helix do this with the Lightning connectors, but still interesting information coming out due to all this hacking that's been going on. A little bit of good news, bad news for you jailbreakers out there this week. Actually, last week saw the first worldwide developer jailbreak conference take place in South San Francisco. That's the little bit of good news. The event featured some of the most elite members of the iOS jailbreak community and the Chronic Dev team giving talks. Unfortunately, though, for folks waiting on an iOS 6 jailbreak, there was a bit of bad news delivered at the conference. Despite some reports that an iOS 6 jailbreak was practically complete, several times during the convention, it was mentioned that the team does not have a working untethered jailbreak for iOS 6 ready to go. The leaked information of Cydia running on an iPhone 5 was legitimate, but Pod2G, one of the Chronic Dev Team hackers, called that a fail break, meaning that it was really internal only at this point and not ready for prime time. They say that they will get there with an iOS 6 jailbreak, but it is likely several months away at this point. One of the issues mentioned is that the number of hackers actively working on the project is relatively small. They say that with more help, they could achieve a jailbreak faster, but there really was no information or word on when that help would come or where it actually would come from. So I guess if you're a hacker out there and really into jailbreak and you have some skills, you might want to contact the team and see if there isn't some way you can help out. Maybe that'll help get the iOS 6 jailbreak out there a little bit quicker. But at this point, it's sounding like it may be a few more months before you actually have that. So if you've been waiting on upgrading for a jailbreak, you might be waiting just a little bit longer. Now I have a little bit of rare good news for AT&T iPhone owners, specifically those of you who bought iPhone 5s off contract. TechCrunch reports that off-contract iPhone 5s can apparently be unlocked by simply doing a restore in iTunes. Doing so will get you a message saying, congratulations, your iPhone has been unlocked. So no delay in getting your device unlocked if you are off-contract. That's actually something similar to the process that you would go through if you had a off-contract older device. You can request an unlock from AT&T through their website, and once you have approval, you actually hook it up to iTunes, do a restore, and at that point it notifies you that the device is unlocked. It sounds like with the iPhone 5 now, though, if you are off contract, you don't have to go through that additional step of actually requesting the unlock. So that's a little bit of good news. Last week, it was also discovered that the Verizon iPhone 5 was completely SIM unlocked out of the box, meaning that you could use them internationally, at least on some LTE networks, and in the U.S. on AT&T's 3G network. I guess you can't, because of the frequency limitations, use a Verizon iPhone 5 on AT&T's LTE network, so that's a little bit unfortunate. And of course, you also need to have an appropriate carrier nano SIM, so you need to get your hands on one of those. I have seen some reports that you can actually cut down a micro SIM into a nano SIM size, although I don't think that's relatively easy to do, and I don't know that they have availability of commercial SIM cutters quite yet, although I would imagine those are coming out on the horizon. The reason for the Verizon iPhone 5 unlock appears to be that there are some FCC requirements for the 700 megahertz spectrum that require Verizon to have an unlocked handset, and that is why they were shipped out of the box, and also why we're hearing reports this week that they will not be SIM unlocked. Some people were thinking that maybe it was just a mistake and Verizon was going to come back and SIM lock those devices. That isn't going to happen, and I think that's an official word that came out from Verizon themselves. Now, the one bit of bad news that is in this report is that despite early assumptions that Sprint devices may also be SIM unlocked out of the box, the Sprint iPhone 5 models are SIM locked and customers can request an unlock, but only after 3 months of being on contract. So if you're a Sprint owner, you're going to have to go through the normal process they've always had of being a good customer for 3 months, and then you can request your unlock, which they'll do if you need to travel internationally or want to use the device on another network. This week saw the end of the free additional iCloud storage for those customers who transitioned over from MobileMe's paid plans to iCloud. Customers were beginning last week to get notified that the 20 gigabytes of free additional iCloud storage was going to be going away. That additional storage ended on September 30th. If you remember, Apple, during the transition from MobileMe to iCloud, offered paying customers an additional 20 gigabytes of free storage as an incentive to convert their accounts over. Those accounts should have been transitioned down to the 5-tier amount on September 30th, unless customers opted to pay an additional cost for one of iCloud's paid plans. Apple offers 10 gigabytes of additional iCloud storage for $20 a year, 20 gigabytes for $40 a year, and 50 gigabytes for $100 a year. TUAW, though, did note that some users are reporting a glitch this week that storage set on X MobileMe accounts is beginning to show 250 gigabytes of additional storage available with an expiration date of September 2050. So if you did pay for those one of those paid upgrade plans, your account may be showing that you have a lot more storage than you thought you paid for, also for a lot longer. General consensus is that this is some sort of glitch that possibly happened with the transition, and Apple will likely be rectifying that very soon. So don't expect to be having that additional storage for very much longer if you've seen it on your account. If you're an owner of a new Verizon iPhone 5 and you suddenly discovered that your cellular data usage seemed to have skyrocketed, you can now rest assured that the issue is likely not your fault. You didn't suddenly become a data hog overnight. Apple issued an alert to Verizon customers that there is now a fix for a Wi-Fi issue related to the new device. Since the iPhone 5 release, there have been reports from some customers and MacCast listeners, I might say, that iPhones were continuing to use cellular data even when connected to Wi-Fi networks. Apple released the security bulletin to Verizon iPhone 5 customers that there is now a fix available. The carrier settings need to be updated to version 13.1, which, according to Apple, should resolve the issue. Customers can get the fix by going into Settings, General, About on their device, and then waiting for the carrier settings update dialog to appear. You then tap the OK button to install the update. After installation, you'll need to hold down the sleep-wake button on your device until you see the slide to power off option. Power off the device and then power it back on, and that should get you back up and running. It's important to note that you must power off the device and power it back on to complete the installation process. You can confirm that you've updated to the new settings by tapping on Settings, General, About, and then scrolling down to the carrier section and verifying that you have Verizon 13.1 displayed. That's how you'll know you're updated. And Verizon, for their part, is reportedly issuing credits to any customers who received overage charges due to the bug. So if you don't see that showing up on your account and you have been affected by this issue, you probably want to take a moment, contact Verizon customer support, and make sure that you get your credit. But good news, if you ran into that issue, it should be fixed at this point. And then, as promised, I have for you one little bit of Mac news in this giant iOS newsified episode. That's just the way things go, folks. I don't make the news. I just kind of talk about it. But we did get a Mac story this week, although it's kind of a small one. Digitimes is reporting that Apple is working with suppliers to eke another 0.15 millimeters of thinness out of future Mac notebooks. They seem to be gaining this slim amount of space by adjusting the light guide that's used to distribute lighting to the backlit keyboard. And if that small amount of thinness doesn't seem like much to make a very big difference, you're probably thinking correctly, because this looks like it's less about reducing the thickness of the device and more about correcting a very small but real issue for users. iFixit is speculating that the adjustment may be to reduce the likelihood of keys pressing against the LCD screen and leaving marks when the lid is closed. The more and more these devices have gotten thinner and thinner, it's become more and more of an issue that the keys tend to ride up in some instances, especially if you have it in a bag and there's just slight compression on your notebook. The keys can actually press into the screen, leaving little marks. And this has been an issue long enough that for me, I've been always buying a RadTech screensaver every time I get a notebook. And this is just a small, thin sheet of material that you can get. In this case, it's a soft, they call it OptiTech, I think is the name of the technology. Basically like a chamois cloth that you can put over your keyboard between the keys and the screen to prevent this issue from happening. It looks like Apple may be aware that this is a problem and just trying to eke a little bit of extra breathing room out of the space between the keyboard and the screen, and they're doing that by reducing the thickness of that backlit keyboard light guide. So, interesting report nonetheless, but probably not very much to do with making future notebooks that much thinner. And with that, that's the news for this week. Going to kick off the feedback section with some information about Verizon LTE speeds. I had said last time that one of the reasons I decided to stick with AT&T was that I had read some reports that maybe their LTE speeds were a little bit better than Verizon's. Boy, was I proven wrong by you, and I had asked for that information. I wanted some real-world numbers, and I wanted to hear what you were finding out there out in the field. I received a number of emails, including speed test screenshots, that seemed to make it appear that the LTE speeds on Verizon are at least on par with those that AT&T are providing, and that your experiences both on AT&T and on Verizon seem to jive with the experience that I was having, in that not all LTE in all locations seems to be created equal. Location seems to play a huge factor in how fast of a download or an upload link that you get on LTE. And you also confirmed for me that even within the same LTE city, dependent upon where you are and what kind of signal you're getting, there's large variances in the speed of LTE. I'm seeing everything, again, ranging from what I saw in my area from about 6 to 9 megabits on the download all the way up to, I think the highest one anybody has sent me so far is 46 megabits on per second on the download, which is just screaming fast. And no doubt LTE at the very minimum seems to be, at least for me, about double the speed that I was getting on the HSPA Plus network with AT&T. Although someone did send me a screen test report showing that their HSPA Plus download speeds on AT&T were 12 megabits a second. And I think the theoretical maximum that AT&T can get up to is something in the range of 46 megabits per second down on HSPA Plus, although I've never seen that that speed reported by anybody yet, or at least not out in the real world. So needless to say, it looks like LTE, Verizon, AT&T seem to be very comparable, at least from the reports that you've been giving me from the field. The other interesting report that I received is that some AT&T customers seem to be getting LTE coverage in places AT&T hasn't officially announced LTE coverage for. I'm not really sure why that is. I'm only speculating at this point, but I'm wondering if AT&T might not be lighting up certain LTE spots and towers and locations in advance of actually announcing an official rollout for a city, and that might be what some of you are running into. Not really sure. There's obviously no official word from AT&T, but it was an interesting side note of this whole experiment nonetheless. So if you've been getting LTE either on Verizon, Sprint, or AT&T in a region that's not officially announced, I'd be curious to know about that. Shoot me an email, send me a speed test report or something like that over at maccast@gmail.com. So as we were talking about earlier, Apple's having a little bit of trouble with their maps and their map data, and I mentioned that one of the ways that they can fix it is by getting real human beings to actually vet and check and confirm some of that location data. And of course, the biggest way Apple will be able to do that is by hiring additional experts, but another way that they do that is through crowdsourcing. They actually have some features built into the map application where you can help update the data, and apparently from some of the reports that I've been reading, they are resolving some of those issues pretty quickly after you submit an issue. But a lot of people don't know exactly how to submit a report or an issue of a problem to Apple. So I thought we'd do a little quick tip here to let you know exactly how to do that. If you're using the mapping application and you find an issue with directions or markers or location, if you just tap on the curled page area in the lower right corner of the screen, it will roll up and you should see a report a problem link. You can click on that and it should pop up a wizard to walk you through how to exactly report your issue. If you find an issue specifically related to a local search, incorrect business information or an incorrect location for a business, there should be a report a problem button that appears at the bottom right of the information card. So when you drill into the information card for that location, you should see the button there. And again, tapping on that should bring up a wizard that will allow you to walk through and report a specific issue. I've actually reported a couple issues. I haven't gone back to see if they were resolved yet, but I did read some reports that in some instances, Apple resolves them within 24 hours or just a few days. Some types of issues seem to take a little bit longer than that, but all of us can kind of help maybe Apple update that data. And they had mentioned that that was going to be a big part of the mapping application, was sort of crowdsourcing some of the data and information. I know they're doing that with Waze on the traffic side of things as well. So just a little quick tip for you there on helping to improve the Apple Maps. When Apple released iTunes Match, I was a little bit hesitant on whether or not the service was going to be something that I was going to use or like. I had some concerns about the download nature versus streaming nature of the service and things like that. I signed up cautiously at the beginning, but slowly found that I've become a pretty big iTunes Match user. I really no longer sync my music through iTunes on my iOS device. I just rely on iTunes Match, and luckily I'm still grandfathered in on the AT&T unlimited data plan, so I don't have to worry about that piece of it too much. And I've been using it quite extensively, including after the upgrade to iOS 6. And luckily for me, I've not run into any issues. But unfortunately, one of our listeners, Greg, has, and he sent me this question.
Hey, Adam, this is Greg from Munich, Germany. I have an interesting topic. Actually, it's a flaw, a major bug in iOS 6 I'd love for you to discuss on your next MacCast. It's been 2 days, and my iCloud won't connect anymore. That's not true. My iTunes won't connect to the iCloud anymore, and I cannot access any music that I have in the iCloud. Furthermore, I cannot access any music via iCloud on my iPhone 5, which I recently got. And that seems to be a major issue, that the latest iOS 6 update really crippled iTunes Match. And it's causing definitely problems. People cannot access the music that they have stored in the cloud. What do you know about this? Is Apple working on anything? From what I read on the forums is that Apple actually claims to never have heard about the problem. It's basically keeping silent about this. This cannot be true. So maybe you could make this a topic in your show, which I always love. I've been an avid listener for years. All the best, and thank you.
Hey, Greg, I will make it a part of the show. Here it is. And, I had not heard about this problem. I did have, I think, one other person email me who was reporting some issues. So I dug in a little bit, and I found a good report over on Macworld. It was more of an iOS bug piece, pointing out a few bugs that they've discovered in iOS, but they specifically did address an iTunes Match issue. So I don't know if this is exactly your issue. Maybe it's something else, but it sounds similar enough that I'm going to roll with it and see if this doesn't resolve your problem. And what they say is that some users who have upgraded to iOS 6 who had iTunes Match enabled during the update are finding that the music shows up in iTunes and in the music app on their device, but is unplayable. They also note that in some instances, it'll show the tracks with a length of 0 minutes and 0 seconds, or worse, that in some cases, when you go into the music screen, it'll just display a message that says no data, like there's no music on there at all. And what the piece notes is that iTunes Match, while it appears to be on the device, is actually turned off. And even going into the settings and turning on iTunes Match, it'll show that the toggle switch is on, but when you go back and you return to that screen, it's actually turned off. And they say that the fix would be to reset your network settings. So what you have to do is you have to go into Settings, General, and then select the Reset option and select the reset network options or network settings specifically. So click on that. When you do that, it is going to reset the network settings on your device, meaning that you're going to have to reconnect to any of the Wi-Fi networks that you normally would connect to. And you'll also need to re-enable iTunes Match. But according to Macworld, once you do that, at that point, you should stay reconnected and you should regain access back to all of your iTunes Match music. Now, there's a couple other things they point out in the piece that you should be aware of related to iOS 6 and some other iCloud changes specifically related to iTunes Match. And one of those is that in enabling the iTunes Match feature, it will now warn you that iTunes Match is going to replace all of the local music downloaded onto your device via iTunes. If you remember before, it really wasn't this way. It would give you the warning, but it actually, if you had synced tracks over locally and you already had them downloaded and stored on your device, they would remain there and you wouldn't have to re-download them through iTunes Match again. I guess now it actually will wipe out any local music on the device, and anything that you want to listen to, you're going to have to re-download. And that re-downloading has gotten a little bit trickier, specifically if you want to download individual songs. It now appears that the music app in iOS 6 does not offer the ability to download individual tracks anymore. You actually have to go in and download either entire albums, entire playlists, or entire artist catalogs. There is no individual track download option. And I think this has to do with the change that Apple made where iTunes Match now legitimately streams music in the background. So if you're looking at your songs and you just click on it to play it through iTunes Match, it actually is going to stream. It's not going to download locally to the device in the background and take up any additional storage space. Now, the only workaround I've been able to come up with for downloading individual tracks from iTunes Match directly on your device would be to create a playlist on the device, call it something like song downloads or something like that. And then you can go into that playlist, add an individual track, and then download that entire one track playlist, which gives you the effect of downloading an individual track. But that's certainly a lot of extra steps to go through and annoying. I hope Apple brings some sort of option, either a click and hold or something, to allow us to download just individual tracks to our devices, especially if we want to listen to something offline. If we know we're going to get ready to go on an airplane trip, I may or may not want to download a whole playlist. I guess it's not that inconvenient to set up one dynamically and download it, but still, it'd be nice to have the option. But those are just a couple of additional iTunes Match changes to be aware of with the new version of iOS 6. And Greg, thanks for the question. I hope this resolves your problem. If not, shoot me another email and we'll try and troubleshoot it a little bit further. Another annoying bug that I am getting reports on sort of relates to the whole Verizon cellular data issue we were talking about earlier. So alongside those reports that some users on Verizon were noticing using cellular data even on Wi-Fi, I've had reports from some users who are on AT&T and who are using the podcast app, they're suddenly noticing their devices using excessive cellular data or extra data. And Bob was one of those users. He said his wife's iPhone 5 was using more cellular data on AT&T than her prior iPhone, even when connected to his Wi-Fi network. And when they were trying to troubleshoot it, he emailed me to say they contacted AT&T and the agent there told them that the new iPhone will always select the best available network regardless of whether it's Wi-Fi or cellular. He wasn't really clear, or the agent, I guess, really wasn't clear on what that exactly meant or how the iPhone would decide what the better network is. Is it signal strength or is it the speed of the connection that is the issue? In Bob's case, AT&T was nice enough to refund and reimburse some of the extra cellular data coverage, but I don't know that that necessarily solves the problem, and I don't know that I 100% buy what the agent was saying. Obviously, if your Wi-Fi signal is weak and it drops at some point, the iPhone is automatically going to switch over to the cellular data connection. But if you have a Wi-Fi signal and you have Wi-Fi turned on and it's on a known network, the iPhone should continue to use the Wi-Fi signal as precedence over the cellular signal. I couldn't find any other confirmation, and I did a little searching online to find out that there's this new feature in iPhone 5 where it's going to pick cellular over Wi-Fi. I remember in the back of my mind Apple alluding to some smarter technology about doing the Wi-Fi switching, but I think it always should use preferential treatment to the Wi-Fi signal over cellular. If that really has changed and I've gotten this wrong, if you know some additional information, shoot me an email and let me know. But Bob, for his part, already started doing the smart thing and what I would recommend to most people in this instance, which is starting to limit individual applications to only download or grab data over Wi-Fi. Many applications have this option. If you go into their settings, you can tweak it and say, don't use my cellular data connection to download additional data or get data in the background. Things like Instagram or the podcast app now has that capability. We're going to talk a little bit more about a bug on that one here in a second. But he did point out, and I think Bob is right in doing so, that it'd be nice if Apple offered some sort of global setting that would allow us to say, don't download data in the background for any application over anything other than Wi-Fi. Now, obviously, a workaround for this, or maybe not so obviously, but a workaround for this in the meantime, in lieu of having a global setting, would be to go into your settings under general, go into the cellular settings, and completely turn off cellular data by hitting the toggle switch when you're connected to a Wi-Fi network. But that's not really convenient. That's not the way most of us operate, and that's not how the operating system is supposed to handle it. So if there is some sort of bug where it's not staying connected to the Wi-Fi network and then dropping and going to cellular, I think we have had some reports of people just having Wi-Fi issues in general. I've particularly noticed that my Wi-Fi signal on my iPhone 5 appears to be a lot weaker than it is on my other devices in the same house on the same Wi-Fi network. So that may be related to this, that that weak signal is causing a drop and causing you to kick over to cellular. But that shouldn't be happening. And so hopefully, if Apple does have a problem here, they're going to issue a fix relatively soon. The other potential culprit that I've seen reports of for excessive data usage may be Apple's new podcast application. And especially if you have the settings set for it to download new podcasts in the background. I've had a few listeners report that they were suspecting that the podcast app seemed to be double downloading, or actually downloading multiple copies of the same episode and basically replacing itself over and over again, even though you already downloaded it. And there was a Tidbits piece last week that seemed to confirm that behavior. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. Luckily, they were saying this was prior to the 1.1 update, and with the 1.1 update, you now have a switch, as I was saying, where you can limit downloads to Wi-Fi only. That does appear to be working. No word on whether or not the podcast 1.1 update fixes the double download issue that people were experiencing. So I would advise, if you're using the podcast app and you're downloading podcasts in the background, you probably want to toggle on that limit so that it only downloads over Wi-Fi, just in case there is still a bug where it's downloading over cellular. I think all of you know at this point that I'm not the hugest fan of Apple's new podcast app, although it does seem to be getting better with each new update and release. Apple is really recommending that if you're using the podcast app, that you upgrade to iOS 6 and that you use the latest version of the application for the best performance and reliability. So if you are on that platform and you want to use the podcast app, you should upgrade across the board, both the operating system and the podcast app. I still have a few people who have reported to me that they're still having download issues, specifically with the MacCast, even on iOS 6 and even running the latest version of the podcast app, although it seems to be a lot less prevalent. Less of you seem to be affected by that issue. If you are having that issue, please let me know, specifically with iOS 6 and the latest version of the podcast app. If you still can't download the MacCast, let me know. Send me an email, because I'm delivering those reports to Apple. We're trying to nail down this bug. It's been a problem with just AAC enhanced podcasts like the MacCast, where for some reason they'll stream on the iOS 6 podcast app, but they won't download. And we're having trouble nailing that one down, but most of you are reporting that the issues have been resolved with the latest version of the application. And for any of you who are still having trouble, or maybe you're on a device that can't upgrade to iOS 6, I really recommend using a third-party application, something like Downcast or Instacast. They have a lot of great features. Actually, I think in many ways they're better and more feature-rich than Apple's podcast application. Barring that, I would say your best bet is to remove Apple's app altogether. Again, this is for people who can't upgrade to iOS 6 or the latest version of the podcast app. You can remove Apple's app altogether. I gave that tip on the last episode of the MacCast, and in doing so, that'll put podcasts back in the music application. The disadvantage there is you're not going to be able to download directly on your device. You're going to have to download in iTunes and sync your podcasts over, but they'll work, and I think that's more important for most of us. So that's the way to go. But really, just look into the third-party apps. They're really great. They're only a couple bucks, well worth the money that's spent, especially if you want to download directly on your device and you're using an older device that can't upgrade to the latest stuff. Next up, Nathan ran into a little issue with iPhoto albums that won't sync. He pointed me to a thread on Apple's discussion boards with reports from users who say they can't sync photo albums from their iOS 6 devices after upgrading to iPhoto 9.0.4. What they're getting is an unknown error message 1140, and in iTunes, the option to select specific events appears to be grayed out so that you can't actually sync those over to your device. And even more annoying, it appears that while the photos aren't showing up on the device and they don't appear to be syncing, the space is still used up even though the photos aren't there. So it's eating up the space. It's looking like the files are transferring over, but you don't have any options. And so I was reading through the discussion thread and found that there was another link to a different discussion forum that seems to have a fix. And the theory is, Nathan, that the culprit might be a special symbols or characters that are in the album title names, or possibly the names of the events, something like that. Could also be the image titles themselves, or in some cases, even song titles. if they're attached, if those photos are attached to a slideshow that you're trying to have photos in that sync over. So it could be a number of various special characters, but the running theory seems to be that the ampersand symbol is particularly one of the problems. Other symbols like curly quotes or maybe even greater than, less than symbols, possibly the asterisks might also be issues. So you probably want to go through your iPhoto library and remove any of those special characters from your album titles, your image names, your song titles that you have attached with slideshows and clean those things up. Apparently in doing that, that'll bring back the syncing functionality and allow you to enable those options within iTunes, at least until Apple issues a fix. Now, I think this had been a bug in the past that was squashed and seems like it may have been reintroduced in iOS 9.0.4, at least according to some of the things that I was reading on those discussion threads. But that seems to be the issue, and Nathan, hopefully that will resolve it for you and maybe some of the rest to you who might have run into this bug. And then finally for today, I think it's no secret that I am a pretty big fan of AppleCare and also Apple's support. I think they generally do a very good job at supporting their products and their customers. And, you know, things happen to our devices even when we're out of AppleCare warranties. And something else that I've talked about is just the ability of not being afraid to ask for support or ask for help, even when you think you might not like the answer. And I have this great comment from Bob this week that I think really illustrates what I'm talking about.
Hi, Adam. Bob from Louisville, Ohio here with a neat story for you. My friend Brian had asked me for some troubleshooting advice on his iPad that the speaker had stopped working after their son dropped it on the ground. Not being a covered repair, he was concerned on bringing it into the Apple Store, but I said, hey, you never know, bring it up there and see what they can do. Well, they brought their iPad 2 to the Apple Store, and the genius proceeded to go back into the back and fix it and bring it back out. And they said, hey, if you have any other problems, just bring it on back. Well, we live about an hour away from our Apple Store, so they said we'd rather not come back if we don't have to. The genius then said, well, let me see what I can do. He went to the back, and he proceeded to bring out a new iPad, a brand new iPad. It was the new iPad with the Retina display. They said, what do we owe you for this? And he said, hey, it's on me. So just another example of how Apple loves to surprise and delight their customers, and an awesome example of customer service. It reminds me of why I'll be an Apple customer for life. Thanks for the show and for everything you do for the community. We really appreciate it.
Hey, you're welcome, Bob. And I appreciate you sending in that comment and just sharing your story with us, because, you know, it is a great example of how Apple very often steps up and goes above and beyond in their customer service. And that's not to say that this experience is going to be repeated every time. I'm very cautious about trying to give anybody the impression that this is how Apple operates all the time. But what I can say is that in my experience, stories like this are not uncommon. You hear them over and over again. It doesn't happen in every case. It's really dependent upon the individual situation. It's also very dependent upon how you go in there and the kind of attitude that you portray and how you act when you're interacting with the genius. And I always say, you know, one of the worst things you can do is act like you're entitled to these sorts of things. Just because you've heard someone else had a really good story and experience doesn't necessarily mean that's going to happen to you. And you have to set your expectations accurately. And obviously, in this case, you and your friend did, right? You said, hey, let's go in there and talk to them. We don't know what's going to happen. They might charge you for the repair. They might repair it for free, which it sounds like they were willing to do. And then they even took it one step further. But any one of those scenarios was a legitimate way for Apple to respond. They could have said, here's the cost of the repair, and we're happy to repair it. They could have done it for free, and they could have done exactly what they did. But you never would find out what they were going to do unless you were willing to go in there and ask. And I think that's the important point, is it never hurts to ask. And I think in most cases, you're going to be surprised and delighted, just like you and your friend were. So I always encourage people to take that tact. And I did the same thing, you know, when I had my accident with my iPad, right? I knew that it was my fault. I left it on top of my car. I damaged it. It was something that Apple wasn't likely going to replace when I went in there. I didn't expect them to, but I was delighted and surprised to find out that they had this out-of-warranty coverage program that meant I could get a replacement iPad at a much reduced cost. I wasn't going to have to pay full boat to get a whole brand new one. And that even that was surprising and delightful. So great experience. I think Apple goes above and beyond in most cases, and I always encourage people to at least give it a shot. And so thanks for sharing the story, because I think it's a great example. And with that, I think that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook and iTrash. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, PDF Pen for iPad, and now PDF Pen for iPhone. They just came out with a brand new iPhone version, and also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. All great software. You can get all the information and details on their products over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, you know, if you want to buy a new iPhone 5 and you need some cash, maybe you want to get some cash back on your old iOS devices, you can head to gazelle.com and do a quick, simple search. Get an offer on that device, and you don't have to deal with any of the hassles of a private sale or auction websites or things like that. It's a truly great service, and you should check them out. Get more information and details over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. You know, at the end of this week, I am going to be in Petaluma at the Mac Computer Expo. I'm giving a couple talks there along with a bunch of great Mac folks. It's also just a great Mac community event. So if you're anywhere in the area, you should check it out. Tickets are just $10. And if you go to maccomputerexpo.com, you can get all the details on all the talks. There's a bunch of vendors that'll be there. You can check it out and stop by and say hi. If you are at the event, please pull me aside, say hi, let me know you're a MacCast listener. I love meeting you guys, and it's just a really fun event. And plus, you can pop over to the, you know, Twit Brick House and say hi to Leo at the same time, since it's in the same town. So a lot of fun, and get details at maccomputerexpo.com. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, any questions, you can send those, of course, to maccast@gmail.com. I encourage you to send along audio comments. You can also leave voicemail on the MacCast listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. You can also reach me on Skype and leave voicemail there. The Skype address is the MacCast. And be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. That's at MacCast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. And be sure to check out the MacCast.com Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And that'll do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.